Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
How is it that we haven't done an open with low-flying helicopter? Because it's here.
The low-flying helicopter was just here a minute ago.
Low-flying helicopter this week really fucked up the Lawfare podcast.
Really?
Yeah, so if you listen to the Lawfare podcast this week, you can. I'm interviewing this sextortion prosecutor, and the helicopter keeps buzzing the window.
They knew.
You know what we need?
They knew.
A drone. I don't want to hurt anybody.
You just want to menace it a little bit.
You have one close call, just and I bet it reduces the problem.
Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Brexy Turkey Benghazi edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast. I think I had that for Thanksgiving last year.
Yeah, that's a great
Brexy Turkey Benghazi.
Is that like a turducken?
Yeah, it's the new turducken.
Or like a haggis turducken, maybe?
It's a conspiracy wrapped inside a big fat bird wrapped inside a disaster.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It never cooks right, though.
No.
It always comes out overdone.
It cooks on the right side only.
Exactly. No, I will not be serving that at my next Thanksgiving table, but I hope that my good friends who are all here with me might be at that table. You like that segue?
We're all here today.
Yeah,
wow.
Ben Wittes is here, Carl Kaufman Wittes, Susan Hennessy. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Susan, you're not drinking scotch right now, but
not
I didn't want you to
time.
Feel left out last weekend when we said
talking
that,
about two-thirds.
I'm
I was
so
literally
sorry.
Sitting on the metro being like, what the hell?
It was entirely my bad.
No, the denominator reflected two-thirds of those present.
Yes.
I'm going to do like a cardboard cutout of me and just place holes whenever I'm gone.
So that
have
I never...
I'll have like
again.
A really stern look on my face,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
And a glass of scotch in your hand.
And a glass of scotch.
A big one. A big glass of scotch. We needed it after this week. Jeez. So this week on the podcast, how will the UK's exit from the European Union affect U.S. national security? Is a terrorist attack in Turkey the inevitable result of battlefield victories against ISIS? And we're going to take on the sound and the fury of the Benghazi report. In fact, I think faced with the choice of whether we should start with one of the most important sort of, you know, defining moments for world and national security policy or the Benghazi report. We should probably start with the Benghazi report.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That feels like the important thing.
Anybody have anything to say about the Benghazi report?
Yeah, I do. 2 years.
Oh, you do? Oh.
$7 million, 800 pages. And that is what you came up with?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm angry. I'm angry because I overestimated Trey Gowdy. I thought he would come up with something crazy.
Smoking guns.
But like,
even
I thought
like
it
mildly,
would be
like,
out there.
Guns that smelled vaguely of smoke.
Right. I thought there would be something.
Yeah.
You know,
nothing.
What I was impressed about this dimension, which is that when they released the committee report, there was also a concurring opinion by two Republicans on the committee who didn't think the report
went far enough.
And there was a dissenting opinion from the Democrats on the committee who felt excluded from the report. So it was Supreme Court-like in its majesty and multifacetedness.
Damning the Supreme Court comparison.
So here's Mike Pompeo and Jim Jordan would really appreciate that comparison.
So here's my question.
It's the best one they're ever going to get.
At least from you, for sure.
Is this an area where, you know, we studied Benghazi and really all we learned was that Hillary Clinton had an email server, which has, of course, is interesting, and it's arguably a much bigger deal than Benghazi in some ways, but it has literally nothing to do with Benghazi. Or did we actually learn anything from this endeavor?
Well, we certainly learned, I mean, look, we did learn the timeline of the events that went down, but we knew those already.
Right.
I mean, Trey Gowdy was actually under a lot of pressure to say, well, what's the new information? And he was like, well, we found there was a White House teleconference call. Like, okay, well, that's great. I mean, that really, we're like now into that level of, you know, part sub B, you know, line three addendum kind of material here, where this is nothing fundamentally that changes the narrative at all.
Right. I mean, it's actually impressive the consistency of the findings across the various reports, starting with the State Department's Accountability Review Board and going through the previous congressional investigations, you know, that basically the findings are the same across all of those reports, even Trey Gowdy's.
Yeah.
So maybe that should give the American people more confidence in those findings that, you know, fundamentally this was a highly dynamic, insecure environment. Fundamentally, the State Department was underfunded in providing for security of all of its diplomatic missions, and that impacted the Libyan missions along with everything else. You know, all those things that we knew.
Right, but the irony, considering the fact that the Republicans, you know, obviously convened this commission and certainly were responsible for the length of its duration, is that the one thing we may have learned over the course of the 2 years is the critical importance of increased funding to diplomatic security, the one thing that they refused to deliver. So it's sort of, I mean, it's a lot of bluster for then not even doing the one actionable policy outcome. I mean, I think it's really, it's Washington politics at its absolute worst.
It's at its worst, both in terms of its extremity, but also in terms of its actual implementation, because if you're going to do Washington politics to that degree, you ought to be able to be more effective than to have a concurring opinion by two additional Republicans on the committee who didn't feel represented by the majority report. I mean, you ought to be able to rally your Republican Party around your politicized investigation, and they couldn't even do that. So it feels, as a Washington politics exercise, kind of pathetic. But I would say, on the diplomatic security point, you're absolutely right, Susan, and it sort of blows me away that this one simple thing, which in the scheme of things doesn't even cost that much, is something that they can't get done. And it's notable, too, that this week Robin Wright has an interview in The New Yorker with the sister of Ambassador Chris Stevens, who died in the attack in Benghazi. And she makes precisely this point. She said, if you want to honor Chris's memory, please increase funding for diplomatic security.
And she said his death had been politicized.
Which I think is indisputable.
Pretty hard to dispute that point. So I have a question. I was trying to think, what's the analog to this in my unfortunately long history of watching congressional and scandal investigations? And the best I can come up with in terms of, you know, an investigation that started when we already knew what had happened and continued long after it didn't deliver anything beyond what we knew. And then when we didn't like the results, we had to do it again, and then we had to do it again, and then we had to do it again, is the death of Vince Foster.
Oh, did not think that's what you were going to say.
Okay. Which was just the conspiracy theory of all conspiracy theories.
Right, except, you know, I mean, at some point, Ken Starr had to say, I'm zero, or he chose to say, whether you know, why is an interesting question. But he ended up saying, let's start over, redo this whole investigation. And there's actually a section in his report about whether there was evidence that Vince Foster had or had not been wrapped in a carpet. You know, because there was this whole conspiracy theory about actually...
She wrapped him in a carpet
Hillary
and swam
Clinton,
to Fort Marcy Park.
Right, and, wrapped Vince Foster's body in a carpet and moved him to Fort Marcy Park. And after Ken found that, one of the interesting things was that the people who were committed to the conspiracy theory denounced him. And the fact that he issued this exhaustively authoritative report didn't really change the discussion at all. There's still a bunch of people who think Hillary Clinton shot Vince Foster in the White House, wrapped him in a carpet, and dragged him to Fort Marcy Park.
Look,
so here's my question. The fact that you have this sequence of investigations that all basically produce the same timeline of events vis-a-vis Benghazi, what will that quell the Benghazi conspiracy theory?
Absolutely not.
Of course not.
Absolutely not.
Look, there are still people who think that the CIA killed JFK. So, or that we didn't land on the moon.
Did we?
Oh, God. So, I mean, in that sense, no, of course, those people will never be convinced. But I think what you would hope that Americans would be persuaded by the credibility of these repeated conclusions from all these reports. But maybe the effect is simply that by repeating these bizarre claims over and over and over again, they seep their way into the public consciousness in a way that is inured to facts.
Right. I think ultimately what it is that people don't really track the story over 2 years' time. And so they sort of assume, like, oh, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? There must be something really serious for this commission to be going on right. and on and on, right? It's this kind of this vague smear. You know, and look, I don't mind politics. I don't even really mind dirty politics. And Hillary Clinton can dish it out as well as she can take it, right? There's no sort of innocent actors in the politicizing game here. That said, I think what's incredibly frustrating is to have this occur against the backdrop of a Congress that just can't do anything. If you can't pass a budget, if you can't pass an NDA,
even finish your pre-cooked, politicized Benghazi report at the time you promised to get it done, and it came out a month late.
Right. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I think makes people not vote and really sort of alienates people from the political process, because it's just, it's so transparent, it's so silly. From, you know, my mouth to God's ears, I hope we never talk about freaking Benghazi again.
Yeah. Well, Shane, can you just promise us, as host of the show, that we will never talk about Benghazi on the show again?
Oh, boy. I don't know. Please, I mean, please. What happens, like, when a year from now, when it found out that Vince Foster, like, helped originally set up the outpost in Benghazi and the blueprints of it 25 years ago, and she... No, we'll never fucking talk about
that server
again.
Was wrapped in a carpet and moved to Fort Marcy Park.
Just keep waiting for me to scream, like, jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Let's talk about the really big story from the past week, which we talked about at the top, alluded to at the top of the show. The UK voted, I won't say decisively, but 52% roughly, more than a million spread margin, to leave the European Union. I think safe to say a vote that surprised most people. I was surprised.
Not me.
You weren't surprised?
I predicted
really?
It. You did predict it. Okay.
I predicted both a month before it happened, when I... asked a person who was going to be in London for the summer to be our Brexit correspondent because the thing was going to pass.
Okay.
And then when she couldn't do it, the afternoon when the price of gold was going down and stocks were going up on expectations that Brexit was going to fail, I called up Zoe Bedell and said, hey, this thing's got a pretty good chance of
passing. I hope you shorted the pound.
Yeah, did you buy a bunch of gold?
I did not, but I did.
Come on, man.
My Bitcoins increased in value, though.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
But I actually always believed it was going to pass.
Why? Because you just think the populist rage is unstoppable?
Not unstoppable.
But they also, the Leave ran a better campaign.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
Leave ran a much better campaign, and one that seemed, again, impervious to facts, which says something about our political moment that I think isn't necessarily about, you know, fears of immigration or rage or whatever, but just the way that publics absorb information now.
Hostility to expertise.
All of that may be true, but none of that is the reason that I...
All right. So tell
it.
Us, no, great reason, Oracle.
How did you know?
Because the European Union sucks.
And you would have voted to Brexit, wouldn't you?
And this is really the first time that people, in a long time, that people have had a chance to give an up or down vote on the EU.
That's true. It was a referendum on the EU.
And there are not a lot of countries in which if you give people a straight up or down vote on the EU, they're going to vote yes, because the thing sucks. And that's not to say it's not better than the alternative, but this is a creature of elite bureaucrats creating elite bureaucratic institutions that override countries' national will on issues that are really important to people. The expression of that is often really ugly, like, you know, in Britain, it really seemed to be about migration and anti-immigrant sentiment. But I actually think there's not a lot of countries where if you gave people a straight up or down vote, maybe Germany, But if you gave the French a straight up or down vote, pro or anti-EU, they'd vote it down too.
It's interesting, you know, I think that the southern neighborhood and the eastern neighborhood, as the Europeans put it, if they had a straight up or down vote, they would vote in favor because they benefited tremendously from their memberships, and both financially, but politically, in terms of all kinds of societal development. And of course, the Central and Eastern Europeans aspired to join Western Europe for years and years. They know what the alternative looked like for them, and they very consciously moved in this direction. So even though they might have qualms about the way the, you know, EU policies are made, they still know they're better off in than out. The UK always had a degree of ambivalence about the EU. It never joined the currency union. And
it never joined Schengen.
And it never joined Schengen fully. And, you know, I think that Schengen in particular has been challenged not only by the global recession that started in 2008 and Europe's halting, bare, you know, clawing recovery from that, but then by the refugee crisis, which, you know, has unfortunately, I think, been conflated in the public debate with immigration issues. But from a European perspective, it's just been a wash of people, you know, challenging the continent's ability to absorb them socially or economically and creating a lot of anxiety. And I think the Leave campaign, even though Britain itself was not very much affected by that refugee crisis, it absorbed relatively few people. Watching it across the channel created a lot of anxiety that the Leave campaign was
sure,
able to
play
on.
Sure, I mean, Nigel Farage, you know, probably in the low point, even I think if his supporters would say the low point of the campaign, standing in front of the bus with the ad on it of, you know, all of these, you know, Syrian refugees, you know, coming across a border, you know, thousands of miles away and making it sound like they were about to, like, you know, march into Trafalgar Square.
Right.
It was interesting. I was talking to Paul Danahar, who's the American bureau chief for the BBC, and he took a little bit of a different slant on this, which is he said, I mean, yes, there was this sort of anti-immigrant kind of a xenophobic sort of baiting that was going on, but that he felt that there was something actually maybe a little broader going on here, that it wasn't so much people being anti-immigrant as being, I think more to your point, Ben, against the, you know, the Brussels asserting that they will make that policy for you. And it was this feeling of loss of control, and that all of these big decisions on things like immigration and on the economy were effectively being, you know, outsourced. And I'm reminded of this speech that Nigel Farage, who runs the UK Independence Party, gave back in 2010, which you should go see it on YouTube if you haven't seen it, where he gives this just blistering tirade against Herman Van Rompuy, who is the, you know, the EU, I guess, prime minister or president or whatever of the parliament there. And just, I mean, devastates him, calls him the quiet assassin of Western democracy, says he has the appearance of a damp rag and the appearance of a low, and the charm of a low grade bank clerk.
That's, I mean, very just,
it's awesome. It's great. But it really is this idea where he gets into this, it builds up this moment where he goes, who are you? I've never heard of you. I didn't vote for you. No one I know voted for you. And I think it gets to like this kind of crescendo of anxiety that's been happening of, you know, this feeling that we have actually lost the decision-making power for our own country and that our sovereignty has been assailed.
I think that's a credible point. I think that most national governments, whether they are members of the European Union or not, have lost a degree of sovereignty in the face of economic globalization, in the face of all of the problems of the commons that are deeply affecting societies. And those are real issues, right. but I don't think Brussels is the primary locus of blame for those problems. Those are problems that are related to broader global trends.
Yeah.
And if anything, the strengthening of the EU was an effort to help each of the European countries individually and collectively cope better with economic globalization. So, I mean, I understand the feeling that Farage is representing, I guess, but I think people are misplacing the blame. The other thing, though, that disturbs me about all the post-Brexit referendum commentary is the sort of, oh, this shows that direct democracy is terrible and the crowd is an idiot and, you know, we should have mechanisms in place to override referenda. And I think that it's a misunderstanding of democracy, and it's a misunderstanding of what the vote means, and I find it really troubling.
But I think, look, I tend to agree with Shane's sort of account of, you know, this taking back control, right? That's literally the slogan. I mean, but was it really a rational, for the people who voted leave, was it really a rational calculation of, I would rather make a bad choice for myself than to have you make a less bad choice for me.
You think maybe they were being rational.
Right, I'm saying, like, is that a rational calculation? Like, my democratic expression, I know this is going to hurt me. I know that the net outcome is going to be a bad one, but it's more important to me to make this choice for myself.
As a parent of teenagers, that is completely rational.
There's a great editorial cartoon that I saw where it's like a little dinghy going up a creek that says Shit Creek, and the guys are all standing there and they say, now having voted to get rid of our paddles, we can take control of the ship.
Right, but so, like, look, if that's what happened, okay, I don't think it's fair to sort of say, oh, you know, this is the failure of direct democracy and this is sort of the problem. However, if the alternative is that the Leave campaign ran a fact-free, messaging system, essentially, right? That essentially people voted based on a series of lies, sort of perpetuated by a group of people that never really thought the vote was going to pass, and it turns out now have literally no plan. I mean, like, that's not an exaggeration. Yeah. There's not a plan. Right, and so then it's a giant group of people who've been tricked. And that, I think, does show that there are perils to this sort of to direct referenda, especially on really, really critical questions.
And, yeah.
But can't it be both? Can't it be that people were responding to a real sense of loss of control and a desire for greater autonomy and greater local autonomy, and that they were persuaded by bad facts? I mean, every political campaign has spin and bad facts. I don't think you can just say, oh, well,
yeah, we're in the midst of one right now.
But when you're in a mediated system, there's some sort of safety valve for that, well, right? So people lie in a presidential
Isn't there
a
media in the UK who can fact-check people? Isn't there?
But they have to give equal time to both sides. I mean, and many people thought that if you watch BBC, you would think that these were two reasonable positions.
So first of all, I think we are in an unusually bad position right now to lecture any other country about fact-free campaigns.
No, this is the moment we can do this, because they're even fucking crazier than we are.
No, but hang on a second. We just ran the second...
Seize the high-low ground, then.
just ask the question. A country that just had a campaign in which, you know, millions of voters voted for the proposition Ted Cruz would be a good president. Donald Trump would be a good president.
Come on, at least Ted Cruz
Bernie
got elected
Sanders
to the
would
Senate.
Be a good president. I mean, these are remarkable propositions that are about as factless in their basis.
In our defense,
as leaving the EU is a good idea.
In our defense, though, lots of people had to vote in multiple different occasions. One thing I cannot get over is why. I mean, I understand how it happened in the narrative, but why a proposition of this enormity would be put to a straight up or down 50% plus one vote one time? With nothing about turnout requirements. I mean, we would never amend the Constitution.
Well, because David Cameron did not expect it to
right.
do well.
Of course. I mean, and somebody said that...
And that's because he didn't call me.
There you go. He didn't. I mean, somebody, I think it was Philip Rennie from The Economist, was talking about that to understand Cameron, you have to fundamentally understand that he's a gambler and he takes choices. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, gambled with the future of Great Britain on this, and he lost. But, I mean, that's a hell of a gamble. I mean, why you would set something up, like, in this way? I mean, I maybe the political
maybe
forces...
Maybe because you do believe in the wisdom of crowds.
Oh.
But then the question becomes, however we got here, or they got here, what now? Did the Europeans take a hard line to prevent other people from following suit? Should U.S. policymakers be encouraging kind of a kind, gentle, understanding response?
Like, well, let's talk about this in the context of like what that means for us,
which is the important
the big U.S.
thing.
Well, and what it means specifically in the security space.
Yeah,
because I mean, you know, we could be the Diane Friday News Roundup for all.
Right. So Kerry,
who the hell listens to that?
Ooh, meow. Kerry was in Aspen speaking at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and his sort of sunny side up take on Brexit was, this is going to make NATO even more important.
Which might actually be true. He might be right. Yeah.
But if that's really, you know, if it makes NATO more important to the United States and U.S. security strategy transatlantically, then that's also a source of concern, because NATO has been a rate-limiting step to a certain degree for the United States. In a number of instances, it's been disunified on the response to Ukraine. And I think if the U.S. has to rely more on NATO, it's actually more of a challenge.
But talk about sort of, you know, everybody sees only within their own sort of world or sphere. Tim Edgar wrote a piece on Lawfare right after this, noting that the Five Eyes have now lost their inside man in the European Union, right? Because nobody else in the Five Eyes is part of the European Union. And so that has dramatic ramifications for intelligence sharing and all of this other stuff. So I think that there's a case to be made that it advances the security position or harms the security position on any sort of number of metrics. My sort of more undifferentiated concern is that anything that promotes chaos at this point has to be a bad thing, right? There's already so much chaos that...
Well, I wouldn't say chaos. I don't know that it's promoting chaos, but it is certainly uncertainty. And uncertainty is not a good thing right now. And it's never a good thing economically, but it's not a good thing, especially in Europe, especially in the current environment.
I think the word is entropy, right? It's increasing the tendency of things to proceed in unpredictable and unpredicted directions.
Right. I mean, one thing that probably is unequivocally true is that this is all good news for Vladimir Putin, and anything that's good news for him is probably bad news for us.
And he still has not responded to my fight challenge.
Well,
wuss.
You should go fight him in the U.K.
Yeah, there you go.
Anytime, any place, he doesn't have the authority to have me arrested after he takes an independent drug test.
Oh, this is a new thing you've thrown on.
Yeah, where did that come from?
I think in light of recent events.
In light of recent events,
it's only
prudent.
The Rio disqualifications.
Yeah. And we should also say, I mean, you talk about being good for Vladimir Putin. I mean, we've talked many, many times on the podcast about Donald Trump and his rise and what that, you know, says about U.S. national security and what that might pretend for it. You know, Donald Trump was in Scotland opening a golf course
because of something irrelevant and having irrelevant things to say about the issues.
In which he applauded the Brexit, even though it appeared from an interview with Michael Wolff in Vanity Fair 2 weeks earlier. He did not know what the Brexit was, putting that aside. And saying he embraced this as people taking their country back. And to your point, Susan, I mean, this is, look, I mean, we've talked a lot too on the podcast about the ties and the closeness and the mutual affection between Putin and Trump. I mean, I think that it's not putting too fine a point on it to say that, you know, Trump represents
everybody.
Well, it's our kind of Brexit moment, right? I mean, this is a wave that's happening. I mean, maybe it's not a wave, but like there are echoes. I find echoes.
There are,
and I'm not saying they're one-to-one, but it's instructive. And you know, if we're imagining a world in which there is a President Trump, a Commander-in-Chief Trump, I could see him. He's already basically said he wants to make deals on an individual basis with different countries and thinks trade deals are terrible, thinks alliances are overrated. So, you know, in this sense, I mean, from a Donald Trump administration perspective, this is a very good thing for U.S. national security,
perhaps. I mean, he did manage to accomplish an amazing feat this week of putting forward a trade proposal that was condemned by both labor unions and the Chamber of Commerce.
It's true. That was very impressive.
That's a grand unifier right there.
Yeah, that was like his abortion comments. Yeah. He's full of surprises, that guy. He's just doing everything different. All right.
Maybe we should send him to the UK. Things are already bad.
Send him on a retreat with Nigel Farage.
He and Boris Johnson both have incredible hair.
Leader of the Conservative Party.
Yes.
I hear they're in the market for one.
I can tell you that unlike Benghazi, we probably will be talking about the Brexit vote in the shows to come. It's going to be a long, strange trip.
By the way, did Hillary Clinton wrap the Brexit in a carpet and move it to Benghazi?
No, it was a Union Jack.
Ooh.
Oh.
Where was the Union Jack that day during the vote?
I don't know. It was...
There's a missing carpet someplace in the halls of Westminster.
Ask the Queen.
She knows.
Did you guys see the Queen's response, though? She met with, I think, the said, one of the ministers in Ireland, and she said, well, it's been a bit of a busy week.
Love that.
Can
Love
I tell
that.
You my favorite story, by the way, about her mother? It's probably apocryphal, but when the Queen Mother was said to be waiting for her cocktail was late, I guess because the servants weren't bringing it up, and she rings the bell, and she calls down to them, and she goes, I don't know about you queens, but this queen needs her gin and tonic. I hope it's true.
We
God
can all
bless
hope
that
it's
woman.
True.
God save the queen. Okay, let's move on to the terrorist attack at the Istanbul airport yesterday, Tuesday. As we're recording this on Wednesday, we still don't have a claim of responsibility from any group. But a number of intelligence officials have been saying that this tends to look more like an ISIS attack than something by separatist or rebels in Turkey. It was against a civilian target. It sort of followed the MO of the Brussels airport bombing, where there were three attackers working in coordinated fashion. Last I saw, the death count's around 30 or so, so it's a pretty significant attack.
I think I saw 41.
41, okay. Sorry, 30. I was going to say 39. Yes, thank you. My question for this is, that I want to kind of pose to the group, is an attack like this, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that it was ISIS, are attacks like this the inevitable result of success on the battlefield by the U.S., which is to say that ISIS is losing territory, it does feel on the ropes. Are we going to see more of these kinds of attacks abroad, targeting civilians, when ISIS perceives that it is losing ground in the caliphate and has to strike out somehow and continue to sort of maintain its reputation and its allure to people?
So I think it's a good question to pose, Shane, because, of course, this has been a hypothesis for a while, that territorial integrity, so to speak, is part of ISIS's appeal, especially to foreign fighters that they're trying to recruit and bring into the battlefield in Syria and Iraq. And so as they lose territory, that endangers their recruiting, and they have to find other ways of presenting a compelling argument for success. So it seems to fit. But the premise, which is that territory is important for ISIS ideologically or as a recruiting tool, I don't know that we have a clear evidence for the validity of that premise, number one. Number two is, given the dramatic success, I'm sorry to say, of their recent attacks in Paris and Brussels and now in Istanbul, why wouldn't they keep doing this?
Yeah.
It's a big hit.
It's a big hit.
Regardless of what else is going on. So unfortunately, I think we're likely to see more of this either way. And what troubles me about the Istanbul case is that, you know, it's always a case that we have this homeland security response of trying to figure out what made a given attack able to succeed and then close that door after the horses run out. With Brussels, it was perimeter security. Oh, European airports don't check people before they go in. And so now Brussels has this massive standoff perimeter security before you can get into the building. Well, the Ataturk airport in Istanbul has always had perimeter security. And these guys blew themselves up at perimeter security and killed 41 people.
Yeah.
So it's just further evidence of how far behind the curve governments are in figuring out effective ways of foiling these kinds of plots.
But there's actually a couple things. Number one is there's no way to foil this kind of plot. You may be able to foil it at an airport, but there's some place in any large city, and Istanbul is one of the largest cities in the world, there's some place where you can blow yourself up and kill a lot of people. It may not be at an airport. It may be on a bus. It may be, but there's, you can't prevent congregations.
Right, you can't prevent
congregations of people in the kind of volume that will allow this sort of attack. But I want to come back to what you said at the beginning, which is that there's not a lot of hard evidence that ISIS really cares about holding territory. My impression was that their holding territory was essential to their claim to the caliphate. Do you doubt that? I mean, that's sort of the Will McCants thesis, that there's a indelible connection between territory and their claim to legitimacy that makes them different from Al-Qaeda and other Sunni radical terrorist groups.
I agree that that hypothesis has been out there, and a lot of people have found it compelling. But I would also say, and I think Will has also said, that this is an organization that is ideologically flexible. They're dynamic. Their ideology has been dynamic. Their recruiting approaches have been dynamic, and their tactics have been dynamic. Whenever they lose territory, they melt away, and when they have an opportunity, they regroup. And so I don't know that we should assume, yes, you know, you need to have territory to declare a caliphate. It seems like that would make sense. But I don't think we should assume that eliminating their holdover territory existentially threatens them as an organization, because I think we've seen that they have an impressive ability to adapt.
Well, so Phil Walter actually wrote an article probably a month ago on more or less this topic on Lawfare. Hopefully I'm sort of accurately representing it. But, I mean, essentially his point was that there are multiple ICs with the plural, right? There's the center of gravity that's the geographic core, and there are reasons to work to defeat that. But it's important to understand there's also something else. There's a global ideology, and that reducing one is going to have an implication for the other. It doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. There are positive gains, to sort of addressing the geographic problem. That said, in doing so, there has to be, one, a recognition that potentially that we will see more sort of activity in the ideological space, potentially in Europe and elsewhere. And more importantly, that there needs to be a plan for this. There has to be sort of an awareness and some movement to kind of address the increased activity on some other axis.
Yeah, I think there's also there's some interesting potential implications of this attack being on Turkish territory and affecting mainly Turkish citizens, although there were a sprinkling of other nationalities among the dead and injured, but the majority appear to have been Turks. And that relates to ISIS's foothold in Syria and Turkey's role in the Syrian civil war. And, you know, we know that in the early years of the civil war, Turkey seems to have been lax, I guess, in allowing ISIS recruits and ISIS organizers to go back and forth across Turkish territory. But in the past year, I think this is the third significant attack,
fifth,
then attributed to ISIS in Turkey. And there are also terrorist attacks in Turkey attributed to the PKK or other Kurdish movements. But the ISIS problem for Turkey has grown more and more severe. And Turkey, you know, has as yet held back in certain ways from its direct involvement in the Syrian conflict because it doesn't want to support Kurdish operations on the other side of the Turkey-Syria border. But this might be something that drives Turkey to do more to support Sunni Arabs inside Syria who are trying to fight ISIS. Right. And this is exactly the force that the U.S. is trying to build up right now so that Sunni Arabs can hold territory liberated by Kurds from ISIS in northern Syria. So I wonder whether this attack is enough to push the Turks over the edge into playing that role.
But how do you think that plays in with sort of the apology to Putin earlier this week, I guess on Monday, that Erdogan sent a letter to Putin apologizing for shooting down the pilot and that there was going to be sort of a more cooperative relationship? Do you think that this cancels that out? Is it sort of how do those interests align, especially when they would be in conflict in Syria?
No, you're right. It's an excellent question to which I don't know an answer. I mean, obviously the Russians right now are attacking and helping the Syrians attack precisely those same Syrian Arab rebel forces. It may be that for the Turks, the decision to apologize to the Russians had more to do with economic interests and doesn't have any direct implication for strategy in Syria. We'll have to see.
All right, and we shall. Let's move on to object lessons. Ben, you want to kick us off?
So I have an object lesson that is another sextortion study.
Ben, only you are another too prolific.
One? No, this one's not by me.
There's two of you.
No, these are actually from...
Someone else discovered sextortion.
Well, it seems to have not been done in response to the Brookings work, was done by the Crimes Against Children Research Center at the University of New Hampshire and Thorn, which is a very good little group that does, child predation online issues.
So you and the University of New Hampshire are the Crick and Watson of sextortion.
Well, so they did a very interesting thing, which is that they didn't study the cases. They surveyed victims. And they actually got a remarkable number of sextortion victims, 1,631, to answer their survey by, get this, advertising on Facebook.
Wow.
And they got... they put a Facebook ad, said basically, click here if you've been sextorted.
Gotta take it to where it happens, right?
Right. Yeah. Got 1,631 sextortion victims to fill out a survey. I have not.
How likely are you to click on a Facebook ad from someone you don't know?
so don't make fun of them. It's good work.
And presumably they were vetted and all this.
Well, I think they clearly gained people's trust, but they...
I actually do think it's an interesting point, though, that it's, all sorts of valuable stuff happens through these types of interactions, and...
Right. So here is... there's a lot of interesting data in here. Here is, to me, the single most interesting finding, at least that's in the summary, which is in a section on the impacts on victims... Fully 12% of victims reported having to move as a result of what had happened to them. So I think that's just a really sort of powerful single number that reflects the severity of some of these. So if you do the math, 12, that's more than 160, it's close to 200 people. That filled out this survey who had to move as a result of the activity in question.
That is shocking. Yeah. I mean, it's good to see that a body of work is building.
It's building a body of work.
Susan.
Speaking of a body of work, CIA bodies, my object lesson is this awesome FOIA. I think Muckrake or Muckrock.
Muckrock, yeah.
Pried this loose. It's a series of CIA complaints about Sodexo and the quality of the cafeteria.
At CIA headquarters?
Yes.
Sodexo, which, as my son pointed out to me yesterday, runs every cafeteria in the world.
Yes.
And it's French, by the way.
They're French?
How's that for
an outsider? I think it provides a lot of, foodstuffs to
right. You wouldn't call it. You couldn't call it food under the law, but edible.
Like when you go to a restaurant and you have like the crunchy fries with your hamburger, chances are they were made by Sodexo or Cisco.
Really?
Oh yeah. So many restaurants buy their food in bulk from people. It's terrible.
Well, at Langley, they're charging 50 cents for a piece of bacon.
What?
And there's a very
highway robbery.
Officer. Somebody else is very angry because the sour cream is now out of reach behind the sneeze guard. There used to be real guacamole. Now there's not real guacamole.
What is the substitute for guacamole?
I don't know. Fake guacamole.
Yeah. What was the text of the FOIA request that produced
I don't know.
Insights?
That's a good piece of information. Anyway, my immediate response to this was, what a bunch of ingrates. Because anyone who has taken the tour of the cafeterias of the intelligence community knows that the CIA has hands down the best cafeteria, followed closely by Liberty Crossing, and then 100 places down the list, Fort Meade. Fort Meade had the worst cafeteria.
Do you sense any bitterness here?
It became a congressional issue.
Really?
Like, it is, if I have to ever eat NSA chili again, and that's what they called it, NSA chili, I don't
Did they call it chow, too, to, like, add the military?
There was just
the
something very,
to all that?
Yes, it was, there was an unpatriotic element to the whole exercise. Anyway, I just thought the cafeteria wars are a genuine bone of contention among the IC, and so to see it spelled out in black and white, that not only do they have it substantially better than anybody else,
But they're complaining about it.
I should do an investigation of this, which would be guaranteed to like make one set of agencies
thing.
Absolutely love me, and another will just turn against me entirely.
Yeah.
So, am I right that this FOIA was the result of somebody suggesting that if you wanted to see how seriously an agency took FOIA, you would FOIA the cafeteria complaints? I believe this is...
That might be it.
The, yeah. the genesis of this little
it's
project.
Test.
And I have to say, it's a brilliant
It
concept.
Actually is a pretty good idea.
My object, actually, it's an article, but it's from The Onion. And I've never shared an article from The Onion, but this one just absolutely delighted me. Headline, Hillary Clinton bowls over catcher to score winning run in campaign softball game. What's also really delightful about this article is that it quotes real people. I mean, it actually, like, used, like, Jim Messina is playing shortstop, and it's kind of fun. But it's about how Hillary Clinton rolled over the catcher and just, like, absolutely body slammed him to score the winning run.
Because she can bring it home.
Yeah. After the staff had told her, don't run from third. It just goes on to be her.
She can make the tough call.
Yeah.
She can bring it home. She can score the run. She's a winner.
And she's like, and she's absolutely like violent in the article.
She's an advisor to the Hillary campaign.
But it's great because it sort of captures, like, I mean, it takes this exaggerated view of her, you know, and she's like knocking over the, you know, the Gatorade, and she's throwing her bat on the ground when she strikes out. My favorite one.
She will fight for everything.
Just for everything said. Quoting Jim Margolis, media advisor, quote, when I was playing second base, she tried to break up a double play by sliding into me with her spikes up. She brushed herself off like nothing had happened. And when I showed her the cut on my leg, she told me to rub some dirt on it and quit acting like a little pussy.
Not that we condone that kind of language here on the Rational Security Podcast.
Oh, God. Yes. 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 Yeah, it's going to be just like this for 4 years. I can't wait.
Nice one, Shane.
Yeah, anyway, I was absolutely delighted and sent that around to a lot of friends.
We're going to have so much winning.
We have so much winning, seriously.
I can much more easily imagine Hillary Clinton playing softball than Donald Trump. Seriously.
Really? And she would cleat the shit out of him, too.
At least she didn't roll Margolis in a carpet, drag him to Fort Marcy Park, and leave him in Benghazi.
And bury him under a server.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. With that, I think we've mercifully come home with the podcast.
Full circle.
Rational Security is a production, of course, of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our past shows on SpaghettiOnTheWallProductions.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at RATLSecurity. And thanks again for downloading the podcast and leaving comments and reviews. As we said last week, there are still some hundreds of you who have yet to leave a review, but many, many, manys of you have been doing it.
Yeah, and to those of you who have not done so yet, Hillary Clinton is going to wrap you in a carpet.
That's right.
Drag you to
Benghazi. To a softball field
in
Libya and drown
Leave
you.
Leave us a rating, guys.
Do it. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Hillary Clinton and the Brexit Burrito.
Oh,
the
man.
Burrito? Oh, rolled up. That's great.
You like that? That's good. I had to think about that one a little bit.
Once again, the best jokes are the ones you have to explain.
Think about them roll over
you. It's a thinker.
Like a catcher at home plate.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
No, of course, our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan, who I don't know whether she likes burritos. I don't know whether she...
She does like burritos.
Leave or remain,
Don't know whether
Sophia.
She likes softball. I cannot account, though, for where she was on the night of Vince Foster's death.
Was she born yet?
I think she might have been in elementary school.
Very vicious elementary school. Thank you, Sophia, for choosing the path of righteousness and recording our music. On behalf of my friend Sophia Yan.
On behalf of Sophia Yan.
And Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.